Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
Now then, you're welcome along to this evening's football show, where later on we'll mark the passing of former Republic of Ireland international Michael Robinson by speaking to his friend and former teammate Mark Lawrenson. In the meantime, Nathan Murphy joins us to go through some of the bits and bobs from the world of football elsewhere. Evening, Nathan.
Evening, Joe.
I must say, and I will we'll talk to Laura about this later on, I had underestimated the extent of Michael Robinson's career in Spain, his media career. That is, I know he played for Osasuna as well. I knew he was very popular, but it was only when you saw the likes of Rafa Nadal and Xabi Alonso and all these Spanish athletes of a certain age coming in to pay tribute to him and saying, you know, you made us love sport, Michael, and you see the guy has 500,000 followers. He was a massive success, which, considering he went over to Osasuna without a word of Spanish, seems like an extraordinary achievement. I'm not quite sure how he managed to pull it off quite so brilliantly, but he sure did.
Yeah, clearly a very, very smart man and somebody who wasn't happy to just rest on his laurels as a footballer. Everything you've seen today, I think, was that he was this iconic footballing figure within Spain in a way that maybe we would never understand unless we grew up watching football in that country. And what a legacy he leaves behind, both as a player from an international point of view, with Ireland, where it seems as though maybe he was just the wrong man in the wrong place at the wrong time, like that one season at Liverpool with the treble. But really, what he achieved after his career, and to leave and get those sort of tributes, having gone to a foreign country at a time when English footballers and British footballers and Irish footballers tended to struggle abroad, to go over, make it his home, learn the language, and be one of the very best, it seems, on Spanish TV, talking to the Spanish about football is quite remarkable.
Well, Mark Lawrenson tweeted today that we played cricket together in our teens. He followed me to Preston, then to Brighton, Republic of Ireland, and finally Liverpool. He even bought my house off me in Hove. So he's very close to him, very sad. Saw Graeme Souness on Sky this morning, very cut up as well. He had just been planning to call Robinson and was even thinking of doing it last night, but didn't want to wake him in case it was too late, and then went to call him today, and obviously the news had come through. So that's on the way.
Well, he told a brilliant story as well, Souness.
Oh, yeah. About seven.
which summed up just how famous Michael Robinson was, that Robinson had told Souness this, how he'd been out for lunch that day with Seve Ballesteros, and about a dozen people came up looking for an autograph, 12 of them for Michael Robinson and one of them for Seve Ballesteros. Yeah. Which just shows the extent of his fame, even over in Spain. And like, he's obviously an incredibly talented footballer who, in my head, he was at Liverpool far longer than the season, because as a player you often heard a huge amount about. Obviously, he was there for one of their most remarkable seasons ever, winning a league, winning a treble, winning a European Cup as well, and playing in those games, and scored a lot of goals. I did that list recently of all-time leading Irish scorers in the top flight, and he's there in the top 10. I think he's 57, 58 goals in the English top flight. So there was a very, very strong career there before he went to Spain.
Yeah, well, just 61, and he's passed away very sadly. So we'll talk to Mark Lawrenson about that later on. In the meantime, when we were speaking last night, just before you got cut off, we had a few technical issues, and we were saying, well, the 4.3 million that the FAI have received courtesy of UEFA can't hurt, and that's a good thing, and that'll be valuable money in this period in particular to draw down and spread throughout the game, whatever way they wanted. And then the Irish Independent were quick with the story. It turns out that the John Delaney era just keeps on giving. There's just surprise after surprise for the current hierarchy to open up and find out what now.
I blame you, Joe, because you were joking about this last night, that maybe there was something that this money could be better used for. It turns out there was something that this money was better used for. Yeah, because obviously the FAIs, we know, have been taking early down payments from all sorts of various bodies down through the years. It turns out that this 4.3 million they already have in their back pocket, and you would assume at this stage very much spent. So while there might have been a lot of joy at certain levels, I'm sure, within the FAI to see this money coming in and potentially safeguarding their future, unfortunately, that money was drawn down under that UEFA hat-trick scheme in the previous era. Which means it's not there, and it's not this boost, and it's not this boost that potentially people were talking about to behind closed doors football in Ireland as well. You just feel we're going to be talking about the legacy of that era for years and years to come.
Yeah. One suspects that Gary Owens and the current people in charge had got in there and had a real look at the books and were aware that this was the case. So I don't suspect, I mean, don't know obviously, but I don't suspect they would have been rejoicing when the news was published yesterday of this payment. They probably would have known that this 4.3 million had arrived. I suppose it's most disappointing for those kind of working in the FAI and beyond, and maybe thinking there was some kind of windfall. But yeah, I mean, you just wonder what else is there waiting for them. And you wonder what other payments have been taken in advance. Again, you would presume the books have been opened and they know that now, but we don't quite know.
And there's a lot of UEFA money due over the coming years as well with Euro 2021. You really hope that that is the financial windfall that the FAI hope it's going to be. But again, you would have to assume at this stage, with all the investigations that had taken place, with all the various people who've been in there as CEOs and interim CEOs, that they are now on top of the financial situation and there's no great shocks. Maybe initially when news came through of this, that it might have been seen as coming from a different fund from UEFA. Maybe it was a special fund set up to deal with this crisis, but it was coming from pre-existing funds that were due to come anyways, that just came early, it seems. Mm. And the FAI, you would hope, were aware of that and there wasn't a behind-the-scenes jubilation and then deflation following soon afterwards like everybody else.
Well, that's the story there. So that 4.3 million is not owing to the FAI. Meanwhile, the breaking news this evening, the big news this evening from a European football point of view came courtesy of the French Prime Minister, Edouard Philippe, and he was pretty clear-cut about this. There will be no professional sport, very much including football, in the country behind closed doors or otherwise until September. And therefore, effectively, Ligue 1 and Ligue 2 will end immediately. We're still waiting absolute confirmation of that, but nobody, to be honest, is supposing that they'll resume Ligue 1 and Ligue 2 in September. So that is another league which bites the dust.
It feels like we should just come back in a month and then see where we are in terms of football returning. Because every 24 hours, it's completely flipped from countries feel like they're really moving on. And England, even yesterday, it feels with Operation Restart, they are moving on. The difference is that this is the French government coming out saying, no, that we feel the best path forward is not to have a return of professional sport. Whereas, as we touched upon yesterday, the English government could well be using football as some form of propaganda and distraction technique, and they want to get it back as a sign to people, well, if football is back and the Premier League back, we must be returning to some sort of normality and things must be getting better. We must be doing a decent job, whereas other countries are looking at it differently. And you would have to expect, we haven't heard a huge amount from the Players' Union and the PFA over the last couple of weeks in English football, maybe they're just biding their time. Mm. But if they're looking around Europe and realising that there are very few, if any, other leagues restarting, why would they put themselves in that position?
Yeah.
So French football, they have a few options. They spoke about this last week. It does look as though Paris Saint-Germain are going to be champions. They're considering three different options. One is points per game, which is the table as it is now. One is roll back to the last completed round of fixtures. And the other is go back to the halfway stage, which you would have to think is unlikely. No matter what happens, Paris Saint-Germain would be crowned champions and the top four in the Champions League places, which does seem to be important from a UEFA point of view, they wouldn't change. Expectation, much like Dutch football, that there'd be no relegation. The question is, and this will probably be could be an issue for English football, you can't really have relegation without finishing the season, but will you have promotion? So that was obviously the huge problem in Dutch football, where Cambuur were fully expecting to be promoted. They were the dominant side in the second tier. And they decide, actually, we're just going to go with the exact same season again next year. And like the huge financial issues that that's going to cause them. They're due to meet possibly later this week, start of next week. Again, much like the Premier League, you would expect you just give Paris Saint-Germain the title. Yeah. They're 12 points clear.
Yeah. What it does do, though, is highlight the irrelevance, really, of what the football authorities talking amongst themselves actually means in real terms. This is a public health issue. The French League were talking about various ways they could make a return and finish the season. And then, boom, just like that, French Prime Minister says, no, we're done till September. And all those conversations disappear into thin air because really they have no power and they've no relevance. And that applies to the UK as well. Because if you look at Germany, which had this situation, relatively speaking, under control, early on, just over 5,000 deaths the last time I checked, which was a really good number for a country of that size. And the Bundesliga looked like they were full steam ahead, things being put in place for a return. The interesting news coming out of Germany and the worrying news coming out of Germany of late is that as they have eased certain restrictions over the last number of days, their reproduction rate, as in how many people you pass it on to, has gone from 0.7 earlier this month back up to 1. So in effect, if I get the disease, I pass it on to one person as opposed to 0.7 of a person. And you need to keep that below 1 so that over time the disease will die out. So very, very quickly, what's happened in Germany as they've eased restrictions is that the R rate has returned to 1 and maybe beyond that, we don't know, or we'll have to see over the coming days. And very quickly, therefore the German government could come out and say, here, Bundesliga. I mean, it was a really nice idea and we would love to help you out here. But the answer is no. And that's happened in France now all of a sudden. So it really will not be surprising if Germany renege on the Bundesliga plans. And as you said, I mean, the UK government can wish to have this as a distraction all they want. And I'm sure they're vaguely aware of the financial considerations. Mm. But when it's a public health issue, when government ministers are facing very serious questions in press conference about death rates and are they doing enough, then sport is low-hanging fruit when it comes to showing how seriously they're taking this.
It is. And at the same time, these clubs are businesses and they have to plan for the future. Mm. There's no business in the country that's just sitting around aimlessly thinking, well, we'll start plans in a month's time. They're all planning for, I'd imagine, in this country next Wednesday, if, and as unlikely as it seems, some restrictions were lifted as to how they get back into business in a safe way with social distancing. So you understand completely, for like a business the size of professional football, why the Premier League have to have plans and have to be ready, yeah, particularly when it seems the advice they're getting from the government is that they want them to get back. And likewise, the FAI, I don't think anybody expects football to be back in this country before the end of the summer, but they are putting plans in place for behind closed doors football. And I haven't really spoken about the financial aspect of it yet, but the story is out there that they sent a statement out to clubs today. Dan McDonald has it in the Independent, of like players taking temperature at home before training sessions, two team buses for away games, no using GPS gear, showering individually, no contact training initially. Like, these are all very sensible things that they have to go through, mm, in the hope that, you don't want to go as far as a miracle, but in the hope that there's some dramatic and quick downturn over the next 6-7 weeks, that they can turn this around quickly. They have to do that planning. But as you say, you just have to look at Germany to see how quickly this can start to spread again. Where England will be different and most interesting is, does it come down to another clash of the government against the players and the players refusing to play?
Yes. No, it's a fair point. We'll have to see how that all plays out. Of course, the other point to make briefly as we wrap up that conversation, and it does seem like we talk about the latest return to plans in the world of football quite often, is the Champions League situation. So Paris Saint-Germain are going along very nicely for the first time in a while, feeling good about the Champions League. If there's no professional sport behind closed doors or otherwise in France, then UEFA, who had been looking at August as a potential finish the Champions League period, they have a major dilemma on their hands. I don't know, for instance, what the French government's reaction would be to PSG playing their home game in London, for instance, if that was deemed okay by the authorities in the UK. I don't know how you fix that if PSG in professional sport is out.
Again, it's the timelines. So, like, would Paris Saint-Germain go to Turin to play Juventus? Like, will you be at that stage? Will the Italians be allowing people come in from France into their country for a couple of days? Or will UEFA end up having to try and do something like the Premier League? And again, you pick London, or a place like that where all the teams have to go for 2 weeks, have to settle down there, have regular testing, and somehow you try and play this off over the space of 10 days. But again, you're getting into a situation where if you're a Manchester City player, you've already done this for the Premier League, and then a month later you're expected to go away again. It's not as if these players don't have elderly relatives. It's not as if they're going to have to go back at some stage to their family. They can't disappear for 6 months just for our entertainment. And maybe and potentially the most interesting comments came from FIFA's chief medical officer today, saying that they just need to forget about football for this season and start again and plan to start again in August, using the line that this is the most serious crisis since World War II. And I think we probably all need to remind ourselves of that at times, that this is the most serious crisis, if not more serious than World War II. And I can't imagine in the middle of the Second World War, people were thinking, let's get football back.
Mm. I'll still rank World War II ahead of it for now, thankfully. But
for now?
Yeah, for where you are. I mean, certainly economically, this story gets scarier and scarier by the day, to say the least. So that's where we are in terms of return to play. Ligue 1 effectively gone, and Eredivisie gone, and Germany, the situation has turned ever so slightly in terms of their outlook regarding the disease, and the UK, as ever, just less clear, a bit more muddled, really, but that's where we are. And the FAI, I'm sure, making plans behind the scenes. Any other bits and pieces going on? I saw West Ham are very worried about holding on to Declan Rice. Chelsea are interested, United are interested. And also, you'll get a yellow card if you spit, is one of the potential changes to the rules, as well as five subs if they do make a return to football. All of that stuff swirling around.
Yeah, five subs would be so your regular three, and then there'll be two other set stoppages, so that you basically can't have 10 separate stoppages for substitutions during the game. I would think, considering you're in the middle of a global pandemic, if you spit, maybe you're going for a red card rather than the yellow card. Or maybe you're looking at, like, it has to be one or the other.
It's a hard habit to break. Hard habit to break.
Exactly. Either you accept that certain players do this. Like, if you do it, again, is it like, does VAR come into that? That's what we need now, a good VAR spitting controversy.
And I mean, I don't want to put people off their dinner, but there are lots of players who are fond of a snot grenade in the midst of, you know, they've got to clear the airways. You see it on camera all the time. I force a habit. I don't know, like, obviously, but in a way, doesn't that capture the ridiculousness of what we're talking about, that, you know, yellow card for spitting because this thing is so serious, and yet we're going to have players all over each other in a box at a corner, sweating, you know. It just shows it's a ludicrous problem to try and solve at the moment.
Yeah, like, there's so many parts of what they're going to stop, such as no handshakes, which we'll all have to do throughout society.
Yeah.
But, like, you look at a corner kick and how close players get together, and how many corner kicks there are in a game, and how long it can often take for a corner kick.
Mm.
Like, there's no social distancing there. Players are going to be right up on top of each other, maybe not spitting, but there'll be fluids being exchanged, I'm sure, somewhere along the way. So, yeah, like, all of this doesn't. We just need some good transfer news, like Declan Rice. I'm sure they can trust Declan to do the right thing and stay. Declan Rice to Chelsea, maybe as a replacement for Jorginho, similar type of player, but unless Jorginho was leaving, you can't really see any real role for Declan Rice in Chelsea's first team at the moment.
No, it looks like someone's going to nab him, though. United are interested as well. But I'm sure you're right. I mean, he'll stay. You know, the value of loyalty and sticking where he started and all that kind of thing.
When will we stop slagging off Declan Rice?
Oh, I think very soon. I think we should give him a break and let him get on with things, shouldn't we?
Yeah, nothing else to talk about.
So, various cheery notes there. I would describe that as one of the cheerier conversations we've had today. We would have to chalk up as a setback in terms of football even thinking about getting back underway on several fronts. That's what today was.
Unfortunately.
Okay.
But the way it's gone in England, tomorrow will be more positive. They'll probably have a full new fixture list released.
Yes. Operation Restart plows on. Who is John Giles, by the way, doing an all-time 11 of this week?
Oh, good question. I need to give him a call and find out.
Does he decide, or do you decide?
Well, listen, you've had conversations with John. You might think you're deciding, but realistically, Joe, only one man is making the decision there.
John, I have a great idea. We should do this. Yeah, no, we should do this. Oh, okay.
Last week was definitely one of his tougher ones. There were a lot of conversations on the Thursday afternoon when he was going through his Chelsea team. A lot of conversations.
Definitely went more towards the modern era.
Yeah, and at the start of the day with more players from that sort of late 60s, early 70s, but two or three of them dropped out. And then there was the big decision about Jimmy Greaves, because initially starting this, John didn't want to have players representing two clubs. But then he put Cesc Fabregas in for both Chelsea and Arsenal.
Yeah.
So he thought, well, if I'm doing that, I'm going to put Jimmy Greaves in for Chelsea. Jimmy Greaves' record for Chelsea was insane. Four seasons, starting at 17, and he scored, I think it was up on 118 goals in four seasons, from 17 to 21.
Yeah, I do.
His last season before he went to Italy, he scored 41 in 40 league games.
Yeah, I think his genius has sort of been lost a touch on our generation. I mean, if John Giles wasn't on here so regularly for so many years, I wouldn't have been as aware of just how great Greaves was. It's just that John always talks about it. Come here, actually, I meant to say it to you. I'll either tweet in or I'll text if I'm listening at the time. Virgin showed the 1968 European Cup final, Manchester United Benfica, over the weekend, and I thought, fantastic. You know, grew up in a Man United house, dad, all that kind of stuff. So I was like, I'm going to watch this. And they, you know, the picture was touched up, so it was really good quality. You had commentary, great. So I watched that. Obviously, there's all the big names. Johnny Aston, are you aware? Like, if I said to you, Johnny Aston, would that ring a big bell?
No.
Yeah, I have to admit I'd be in a similar spot. So Johnny Aston was playing on the left wing for Manchester United in the European Cup final of 1968. He was sensational. I mean, sensational. I thought he was George Best for the first few minutes because the commentaries were a bit different, weren't picking out players. And I thought, how have I never heard of this guy? I meant to check what kind of career he had afterwards because he was only about 20 years of age. And I just looked him up briefly and the 1968 final to see, is it just me who's thinking here, this lad's having an unbelievable game?
Mm.
And the Benfica manager afterwards said something along the lines of, you know, we spent weeks thinking about Best and Charlton and these guys. Nobody told me about the kid called Aston. And he was just phenomenal. So yeah, I must...
tricky left winger?
Yeah, tricky, but like fast, fit, really tidy on the ball. He had the beating of his man. And like in those days, if you had the beating of your man, you had a good day, you know? There probably wasn't as much sophistication or protection via the system. So he just, every time he got the ball, did something really good with it. Either beat his man, got a good ball in, or, you know, little 1-2 around the corner, various little bits and bobs. But all action, brilliant. And I was thinking... 1968 final, looks like the best player on the pitch. The Benfica manager is basically hailing him and he'd passed me by completely. So I might throw that in as a text for John towards the end on Thursday.
Never played for England, bizarrely, just looking at him here.
Yeah.
Despite, as you say, being very much a key part of a Manchester United side for 6 or 7 years.
Yeah. Now, maybe he just had the game of his life. That's the only game I've seen. That's why I'm kind of curious. So John will obviously... No, it's useful having
We'll ask him. There's talk of Manchester City or Celtic, perhaps, on Thursday.
Okay, very good. Look forward to it. Nathan Murphy, for the time being, thanks, Mel.
Cheers, Joe.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
Now, you're welcome back. As mentioned, we wanted to mark the passing of Michael Robinson, aged 61. In a moment, we'll be joined by his friend and former teammate, Mark Lawrenson. Another friend and former teammate, Graeme Souness, was on Sky Sports this morning and had this to say.
He was a big pal of mine, Dave. You know, got so many fond memories of being in his company. You know, if you were going for a night out, Michael would be the first one you'd invite. A real, you know, charming man. Bon vivant, great stories, could tell great stories. I'm really sad for Chris and his kids. I know, you know, he's been fighting this for a number of years now, and it's been difficult for him. And he had recently moved to Marbella from Madrid. You know, but when you look at his career, he was a very good footballer. He enjoyed a year at Liverpool, but we had a, you know, glory year, and he's a big part of that. Then he took himself off to Spain, played Osasuna in Spain, and then he's created a life for himself in the media out there, and he was extremely popular in Spain. I can remember, he phoned me up. He phoned me up one Friday afternoon. He used to go for these long Spanish lunches, and he was celebrating. He got back to his office because he'd been out for lunch with Seve Ballesteros. And he was walking down the street in Madrid, and half a dozen people stopped and asked him for an autograph, and only one asked Seve. So he was rejoicing in that. I mean, he was a proper man. I mean, my friendship started when he first joined Liverpool. We used to go to the Top Hat on a Thursday night for dinner, his wife and my wife. And then obviously we become great pals at Liverpool. And Kenny wasn't on a trip. I remember we went to Israel once. We roomed together, we roomed in other places as well when Kenny was maybe injured, and he was a close pal of mine, and I'm absolutely sick for his family. You know, it's a sad day for me, and it was only, you know, I've tried to ring him a couple of times in the last couple of weeks, and Michael is a very emotional man, and he wouldn't pick up the phone anymore to me, and it was only last night I'm thinking I'm going to try him and try until I get him, and I thought I won't ring him now because he may be, you know, in his bed, having an early bed, and I was going to ring him today. And I've not got a chance to speak to him.
Yeah, it's a really sad end to that tribute from Graeme Souness this morning on Sky Sports. Mark Lawrenson is with us this evening, Mark.
Hiya.
A very sad day for you as well. I saw your tweet this morning. You clearly knew Michael Robinson very well and for a very long time.
Oh, 45 years, I think it would have been altogether. He was a Blackpool boy, I was a Preston boy. We kind of the two best teams, cricket teams in the Northwest. We played each other in this particular game, of which I actually caught him out at cover, and we kind of became friends. I played against him in football then. I went to Preston at 17, and Robbo joined about a year later. I did 2 years, went to Brighton. I think Michael did 3 or 4 years at Preston and was sold to Manchester City. And My stepfather was a director of the football club at Preston North End. He was part responsible for the transfer fee. We got $756,000. It was amazing. And I remember my stepfather saying, "This is telephone numbers. Preston only wanted $250,000, and they just kept saying no all the time. And in the end, Peter Swales, the former chairman, God rest his soul, he agreed to pay $756,000. Well, I was at Brighton, and obviously Michael didn't settle at Manchester. I think the fee was far too high. The expectation level as well because of the fee was just ridiculous. So he ended up coming to Brighton where we played together. I then cleared off to Liverpool, and I just remember, and actually before I cleared off to Liverpool, I sold my house to him at mate's rate, so he obviously still owes me money, I would have done. I went to Liverpool. I remember pre-season about 1983, Joe Fagan had just taken over in a hotel in Switzerland pre-season, and he said to me, he said, Mark, I said, yeah. He said, Michael Robinson. I said, yeah, I know him well, Joe. Good player, handful. You know, I said, probably underrated. And he said, when's the last time you saw him? I said, it's a while ago. He says, we'll see him tomorrow because we've just signed him. So, obviously, he came and joined us. And I remember on one of his first days, he said, what's it like here? And I said, it's absolute rubbish. Obviously, he started laughing. And I said, but the big thing is that you don't, they bought you because of the way you've been playing for Brighton, playing for Ireland as well, of course, which you did join me at Ireland as well. I said, but they bought you for the way you play, not, don't change. You know, there's a real reason they bought you. And he didn't, and he was great. And, you know, he gave you absolutely everything every single week. He would never have been, and he'd tell you this, he would never have been the most talented of footballers, but boy, oh boy, you could really rely on him, and he was like a battering ram. And he stood up to everything, and he was great to play with. I mean, you speak to Kenny. I saw Kenny said something today, Kenny Dalglish and Rushie, and they just said he was, you know, he took all the pressure off them when he was playing. And, you know, eventually, as Graham was saying, and they were big mates, you know, he went on to carve a career. He was basically in Ireland, in Spain, a bit like Des Lynam was in England for all those years. And the other thing about it was that, you know, this was not his native tongue. So he did a fabulous job. And he was, if you went for lunch with Robbo, it lasted a day.
Yeah.
And basically your ears would be bleeding because he never stopped talking. But it was all good fun. And he was just a really, really nice bloke.
Yeah, because you tweeted a picture today of his season at Liverpool, a team photo, and you said Michael Robinson, as we knew him, always smiling, and that tied in with what Graham Souness said as well. He made a massive impact, it seems, in very short periods of time on people.
Oh, he did. He did. And, you know, I think Kenny got injured. I think he broke his jawbone or something like that. And that's why, I mean, we called him the cat. And we called him the cat, not because he was like really light on his feet, because he was completely the opposite. He was heavy on his feet, a little bit clumsy. But you know the way footballers are in the dressing room. You've got to give someone a nickname straight away. So we called him the cat, and he loved it. And he'd come up the dressing room, and he'd go, come on, boys, the cat's here, and everything. He was just one of those guys that would, yeah, he would always come in, and it was always fun. He always had something to say. But very, very intelligent boy. I mean, I know when he went to Osasuna, I'd spoken to him, and he just said, I'm going to learn the language, I'm going to live over here. He said, it's fab. So, and not only did he do that, he's carved out a completely different career for himself.
Yeah. An amazing achievement to do that as well. I mean, I first saw the news today, or one of the first places I saw the news was when Rafa Nadal, no less, was tweeting a picture of the two of them arm in arm together and saying how sorry he was and how much joy Michael brought to football. I saw Xavi Alonso as well, you know, all these Spanish kids who'd clearly grown up with them. And, you know, you check and, you know, we've been aware of Michael Robinson and how well he was doing, but you see he's 500,000 Twitter followers, whatever barometer that is to judge anything.
Yeah,
but it's something in that industry. And how did he manage to do it? Like, learn the language and be that proficient and that popular is a long shot.
Yeah, I mean, he decided straight away when he got to Osasuna that he wasn't going to be a typical kind of, you know, otherwise a European footballer, not learn the lingo and have a translator. He was, no, I want to know what they're saying about me. I want to join in the dressing room in the banter. So he learned the language. And yet, I know when he first started, he was on the radio and he wasn't presenting. He was like somebody's sidekick. But the Spanish people loved just the way that he spoke. It wasn't perfect Spanish and it was kind of funny. But they absolutely loved him because the fact he was just having a real go. You know, instead of someone like, you know, Sergio Aguero, who's like basically will not speak English in any kind of interviews, the cat just threw himself in it, and they loved him, and that's how he started really. And I remember I rang him one day, and I could hear all this noise in the background. I says, and he was in Madrid still at the time. I says, where are you? He says, oh, I'm in the restaurant with the lads. I says, what lads? He said, all the old lads who've ever played for Real Madrid, we meet once every, I don't know, what's every month, you know, on a Wednesday. And, you know, we get the ball out and start pushing and running and all that kind of stuff. And who's there? Well, he just started naming all these names. And I said, how many beers have you had? He said, no, honestly, seriously. He said, did Hento go and play there, Puskas, people like that? Alfredo Di Stefano, and he said it's absolutely fabulous, and they've just accepted me for what I do on the TV and the fact I play football. So that's the kind of life that he was living.
Yeah, amazing. Were you in touch with him often, or every now and then, or
no, not really. I've kind of lost touch a little bit. I'd go when I was in Madrid. I'd go and meet up with him and stuff, but you know what it is like. You know, you get kids, and he had kids and all those, and you get on with your own life. But he was really, really close to Graham. Because when he moved to Liverpool from Brighton, a lot of people had these come and live in Southwark, where the majority of us lived, or they lived on the Wirral. He decided to live, I think he actually was living in the outskirts of Liverpool, where Graham was living as well, and that's how they became really friendly. And the friendship was that good. I remember when Graham signed for Sampdoria in 1984, the summer, because he was such a good friend of Rob, he bought him a Cartier bracelet, like a man's bracelet, and just said, "That's for being my mate." So that's how close they were.
Yeah. Well, you could hear that in his voice this morning, and it goes,
"Oh yeah."
What a dreadful thing for him, you know, to say, that Michael's an emotional man, and he didn't necessarily want to pick up the phone of late to Graham. Maybe he knew the end was near. Perhaps,
well,
I don't know. And
no.
You just miss him, and you could tell the upset that was there. So, like, a lesson to everyone to try and almost keep in touch, especially at the moment.
Yeah, of course it is. And I mean, you know, someone just asked me today, they said, "Oh, will you go to the funeral?" And before the court said funeral, they suddenly realised, bloody hell, we can't go to any funerals. But I would definitely have gone across to Marbella, most certainly, because, you know, I knew his Mrs. Chris very well as well. So,
yeah.
Hey, it's life, but it's not life, isn't it? But when I first heard it this morning, it absolutely stopped me, because I knew he'd been poorly.
Mm.
And I remember he wrote this big piece about, "I'm fighting it, I'm doing all those kind of things." And he's obviously really upbeat, as you would be. But it was just something I didn't expect to hear. And it just floored me completely, and obviously floored Graham as well.
Probably because he was so full of life and so much positivity. And those people, it always lands an extra blow, I think.
Yeah, of course it does. And, he would always, you know, tomorrow was another day, and it was going to be a great day because you'd still be alive and all those kind of things with Rob. I mean, he had some great stories and stuff like that. But, the cat, unfortunately. But, great guy, really seriously was.
And he played under Own Hand. I saw Own Hand paying tribute to him today here in the Irish media. How did he get on with Ireland? Did he enjoy all that?
Oh, loved it. Absolutely loved it. So I remember as well, one day, I can't remember, we were playing, we're at home, obviously at Lansdowne Road, and he got injured, and it looked like a real serious injury. He got stretchered off, and he was kind of waving to the crowd, a little bit like Kevin Moran did on a couple of occasions at Old Trafford with Man United. He was waving to the crowd, and I got a phone call that night from Alan Mullery, Brighton manager. And he said to me, he said, "What's happened to Michael?" And I said, "He looks like..." He said he got carried off on a stretcher. I said, "Looks like he'd be out for like 2 or 3 months." So he was effing and jeffing down the telephone, nothing to do with me. He played on Saturday, which was great. It was just that kind of. I don't know anybody that didn't like him. Really, seriously, didn't know anybody. You know, occasionally I'd not fancy him, there's something wrong with him, he's not wide upright or something. Honestly, everybody just really, really loved him.
Well, listen, very sad news. Thanks so much for coming on, paying tribute to him, former Republic of Ireland international as well, and seemed to be an extraordinary fella. Mark, thanks a million.
Pleasure.
Okay, Mark Lawrenson there.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.